This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Today, on this topic of love, sex, and dating, we are going to go over this topic with Dr. Lyle, and then we're going to have the rest of the show dedicated to some extra questions that people asked regarding this topic. Now, the topic is the magic 10%. And what this magic 10% is how to make yourself more attractive given what you've got. Because we're all born with a certain genetic variability. And if someone, let's say, is born in the 50th percentile of attractiveness, my idea is that they can really never become, you know, a 99th percentile of attractiveness. And so, Dr. Lyle, we're going to kind of go over this and see what we can do given what we've got.
Cool. Absolutely.
All right. So,
Go ahead.
Yeah. Let's, what are we looking for when we're, what is this magic 10%? Why are they the magic 10%?
All right. I call it the magic 10% for the following reason. Yeah. I want you to, realize that the genes that built you were designed by nature to have preferences so that they would make the right moves when it came to survival and reproduction. So that's why they like the taste of things that are, that you can ingest and use for calories called food. It doesn't like things that taste like manure or taste like poison. You like the look of a landscape that's got green and flowers and water in it as opposed to a landscape that looks like a desert. You like temperature that's, you know, 70 to 80 degrees rather than temperature that's 110 or 30. And so in other words, you've got preferences. And the preferences are always aiming towards survival advantages or reproductive advantages. And so that's why if you've got a kid, you're excited if your kid does well in school or does well in some sport or some such thing or wins some contest, because it means that your genes are actually distinguishing themselves from their sexual competitors in their age cohort, and your child is going to wind up with survival or reproductive advantages, where that's what that success is looking like. So when it comes to the magic 10%, it turns out that if you look at the world's efforts in terms of people, they're always trying to get a little bit better deal. So that's because they're trying to essentially trade for in an optimal fashion. So if you've got $20,000 and you're looking to buy a car, you're going to try to not get a $20,000 car. You're going to try to get a $21,000 car for cheap. Okay, so everybody's angling to get a little bit better deal. And this is going to be, that's why pretty much a tremendous amount of commerce takes place in what we're going to call sales. So the right way to run an internet business is to always have something on sale, because that people then think they're getting a better value for cheap for some strange reason. So this is exactly what's happening in dating and romance, that people are shopping to trade their time, energy, and genes, essentially their genetic potential, and they're trying to get a deal. And this is how it's basically going to work. So I want you to think that the standard mating process for humans is in the romance, in what we're going to call the romance and love arena, as opposed to casual mating, which is two different things. So in the romance and love arena is what we're going to be talking about first. We can talk about the other issues later, but this is the fundamental issue. So the stock trade that goes on in our species is that the male is harder to get to commit than the female is. And the male is going to essentially be giving up the possibility of impregnating five different people this month for the opportunity of impregnating one person this year. So the what he's going to do, this quote commitment or love circuitry that exists in our species, comes with the male's feeling that he is going to also going to go out there and hustle and provide and protect that female and the offspring. And so the male is bringing two different assets to the table. They are bringing both their genes and they are bringing protection and provision assets. The female is basically bringing her genes. She is not bringing protection and provision assets. She doesn't protect and provide the male. So therefore, the female is essentially a two-factor mating mechanism, and the male is closer to a one-factor. So the male is trying to get the fanciest genes that he can get. The female is trying to get the fanciest genes she can get, given that she's also trying to get resources. So it's going to turn out that the stock love trade in human nature is going to be for the male to essentially try to sleep up in this arrangement, and he's going to try to get sexier genes than the ones that he's giving away. So let's suppose, for example, that our male is a 7, but he's hustled around and he has a bunch of assets and he runs into a girl who's an 8, and he essentially talks as fast as he can, as convincingly as possible, and demonstrates to her that he's going to give her his undying love and resources, et cetera, forever, if he can just get to those eggs. Now, she may buy this arrangement, and this is going to be what we call a true love trade. Now, let's look at the true love trade, and let's try to figure out why it happened with this guy as opposed to not with some other guy. So I wanted us to start our story with, we're going to start with something that is slightly different than this. We're going to take five males who are looking over at a female. And the five males are, in this case, let's make that they're all 7s. We're going to make them all 8s, just for the sake of simplicity. So we've got five males that are 8s, and we've got a female over there that is also an 8. Now, those five males look over at that female, and 3 of them think that she's an 8. But one of them thinks that she's a 9, and the other one thinks that she's a 7. This is because there is not a perfect agreement between the five males as to the mate value of the female. So it's going to turn out that that's about as much dispersion as you're typically going to find in humans. In other words, humans have very high agreement about how sexy they think the opposite sex is, so they rate them very closely, but they don't rate them perfectly. So none of the males thinks that the female is a 10, and none of them thinks that she's a 6. They all recognize that she's about an 8, but one of them rates her a little high, and the other one rates her a little low, and then most of them rate her right on target and the agreement with the other ones. Now, the female, looking back at these five males, who've all been set up with her on blind dates from five good friends, and the five good friends think, well, that's an even trade. So they all think it's reasonable, and they think that these people ought to get together. So these five males, our girl thinks that 3 of them are 8s, one of them she thinks is a 9, and one of them she thinks is a 7. Now, that's because she has the same kind of dispersion in her opinions. If you took 1,000 females and looked at these five guys, you would find that 60% of the time, the females would think that any given guy was an 8, and 20% of the time they'd think he was a 7, and 20% of the time they'd think he was a 9. And so we have the reverse dispersion of assessment working through her mind. So it's going to turn out that most of the time, if we actually went through these pairwise comparisons and looked at what would happen, we would find that most of the time, both of them would think the other one was an 8. Now, if the male thinks that he's an 8 and he thinks that the female's an 8, he couldn't give a damn. Like that's something that's interesting for casual mating only. He's for a pair bond situation, for a true love situation, he's going to bring a bunch of assets. He's going to go kill snakes and behead kings to try to impress her and bring diamonds. And so as a result, he's not interested in spending his life with an 8. He's spending his life with a 9. So only one of those guys thinks that she is a 9. We're going to call that guy Pete. The rest of the guys, you know, Don, Doug, Devin, and Dibs, the four guys think that she is either an 8 or a 7. So they're not interested. Now, they may be interested in casual mating, which is where it's going to get tricky, but they are not interested for pair bond. But one of them, Pete, is interested in her as a pair bond. Now, we're going to call her Debbie, and she's going to look at these four guys. Now, statistically, there's only a 1 out of 5 chance that she thinks that Pete is a 9. Otherwise, she thinks she's an 8. So she's not too wild about an 8, and she's sure as hell not wild about a 7. So as a result, when a pair of 8s meet, there's not likely to be a lot of sparks flying. One of those males may think she's a 9, so he's pretty interested. But most of the time, she's going to think he's just sort of so-so. She's not all hot and bothered about him. Now, if that 9 is really interested and pursues her hard, and she thinks that he's an 8, then he might get somewhere. But most of the time, what's going to happen is most of the males are not going to think that she's that fancy, and so they're really not going to be interested in a true love strategy. So it's going to turn out that the magic 10% is going to be where both parties feel like they're getting a screaming deal. So that's going to happen actually at first meeting only 1 out of 25 times with this kind of dispersion. So there's a 1 out of 5 chance a male thinks that she's a 9 knowing that he's an 8. And there's a 1 out of 5 chance that that female, who he thinks she's a 9, also thinks he's a 9. So 24 out of 25 times, things are pretty lukewarm when two pair of 8s meet. But 1 out of 25 times, there's electricity. And it's because each thinks the other one is actually fancier than the rest of the market thinks that they are. And so true love is basically born from a miscalibration of those two individuals about the actual market value of the person that they're operating on. So true love is basically based on mutual distortion.
See, I yeah. knew there was something wrong with all those people in love.
Now, it's sort of the distortion that's meant to be in there. Now, very often, it looks a little bit different than this. So, that's just sort of what's happening in an awful lot of meetings that are taking place. There's problems in the marketplace because the females occasionally have the following experience, that they meet some guy who, let's suppose they meet an 8, but they think that 8 is a 9. So they're pretty damn excited. Meanwhile, the guy actually thinks that she's an 8. So he's not that excited, but he can pick up that she's pretty excited. So he doesn't feel like he's sleeping up. He feels like he's sleeping even. And he's not that wild about sleeping even, but boy, if it's there, it's not too bad. And so he will then pursue it, but not behind a pair bond strategy, but behind a casual mating strategy. But of course, at this point, he's actually designed by nature to lie to himself to some degree and to lie to her definitely, consciously and deliberately if he needs to. And if he's got that proclivity, which a lot of guys do, in order to get to the eggs that are pretty fancy eggs, but just not good enough eggs for him to go on all in for all love for a longer period of time. So this is the magic 10% actually takes place when both partners feel like they're getting this fancy deal. And that happens only occasionally. In other words, most of the time, most of us have been out on a lot of dates. And you'll walk away thinking, you know, at best, it would be an okay deal, but I'm not that excited about it. And that's actually the standard, you know, a lot of times you're a little insulted or feel like the person is just simply not acceptable. But rarely do we usually have a situation where one person feels like the other person is a hell of a deal and the other person on the other side feels like the first person is a hell of a deal. In order for that to happen, you have to have this sort of magical 10% firing in both brains.
Mm-hmm. So how do can we create this in ourselves, or can we act in a way, or, you know, display in a certain way that can kind of get that 10% more than one out of 25 times?
Well, I will begin at the beginning. Well, actually, I'll begin to begin at the beginning because we've got actually a massive problem. We've got more than one sociological problem taking place right now that inhibits this process. But I have to tell you that one of the biggest problems that we have is fat. And it is probably the single biggest obstacle there is to romantic satisfaction in the Western world. So you have to understand that as women put on weight, particularly women, as women put on weight, they decrease their attractiveness substantially. So let's think about, and not only that, they don't tend to have the greatest intuition about this. So they tend to, women are, for good reason, they're very focused on faces because human beings rate people's attractiveness heavily on the face. And so as a result, let's suppose that a woman is quite pretty. Let's suppose she's an 8. And let's suppose she was an 8 all the way through high school. And let's suppose she has sort of an 8-like shape. So she's about an 80th percentile. So this is a nice-looking person. And this nice-looking person essentially has her eyes on the following situation. She has her eyes on marrying an 8 that has well above average resources. That would be what it is that she should reasonably expect. That's what she's trying to get. Now, you and I know that that's actually too good a deal. So she's designed by nature to try to find somebody that she feels like is an 8, but we know that it's objectively a 7. Okay? The reason why he better be objectively a 7 is that a guy who is objectively an 8 knows that he's an 8 because he's gotten feedback from the marketplace that he's an 8, and he is not all excited about mating with an 8. So she needs the subjective experience that this guy is a 7, that he's an 8, when objectively he's a 7 and he knows he's a 7, and that she is in fact an 8 who feels like he's an 8, and so she's excited about being with him and he's excited about being with her. That is a true love parabond formula, and it requires that she be distorted relative to the market by 10%, and it actually doesn't hurt if he is distorted by the market by 10%, so that he actually feels like she's a 9. Now, guys aren't that excited about picking up 10%. The real magic for them is to go up 20%. And so that's the magic 10% for them. They expect to be able to go up 10%. That should be stock. But where they're really excited and interested in, quote, falling in love and really being motivated is when they feel like they're going 20% up. And so, as a result, our 7 has to think that she's a 9, even though she's an objective 8. And that winds up being the magic 10% that the two of those people can trade. However, we've got an enormous problem. The enormous problem is the processed, low-quality, high-calorie density diet that is consumed by people in America and elsewhere, but particularly the United States. And as a result of this food, far too much oil, far too much animal, high-fat animal food, and not enough of our natural carbohydrate and fruit and vegetables. If you get away from a more natural food-dominated diet, what happens is people start getting fat. And in the United States, the average woman gains 2 pounds a year between her 16th and 36th birthday. So by her 36th birthday, the average woman in the United States is 40 pounds overweight. Now, this is right during the heart of her most important reproductive years, where she is competing desperately to try to find a really great guy to build a family with. Now, you have to understand that by halfway into this, by 26 years old, she's 20 pounds overweight. Now, 20 pounds overweight, an 8 that's 20 pounds overweight is no longer an 8. So even though she looks in the mirror and she sees 8-like features in the face, and she's not morbidly obese or anything else, she's just moderately overweight, but she feels like, well, that's not too bad. And you know what? It isn't too bad. But really, she's a 6.5 or a 7. And so as a result of that, she's absolutely flushed opportunity after opportunity, and she's going to make it exceedingly difficult for her to find a 7 who thinks that she's a 9. And so the number one thing that females can do in the United States to enhance their own reproductive romance, romantic success, is going to be to move their diet to a much more disciplined situation where they're eating a lot healthier food.
Now, does this this theoretical eight, who's say 20 pounds of weight by 26, she still believes she's an eight because she's gotten all the feedback from the time she was, you know, hitting puberty around, you know, whatever, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, all the way up until she started to gain a little bit of weight. So to her, no matter how much weight she gains, she still thinks she's an eight, right?
Well, it gets worse.
She gets grumpy.
Well, I know. It gets a lot worse. Problem is, if she goes out to a bar and drinks a little bit, and there's guys there that are drinking a little bit, there are guys that are eights that are going to be hitting on her. Because they're hitting on her behind casual mating strategy. And there's even going to be nines hitting on her behind casual mating strategy. And so this gets very confusing because these are like the nice looking guys that were hitting on her in high school. And so it seems like nothing's really changed. And she seems to be with reasonable fashion sense and some decent clothing. She seems to be slipping past the little problem of the fact that she's 20 pounds overweight. So it appears that she's getting away with this and she feels a little bit guilty about it. And she knows that she's not quite on top of her game. But the truth is she doesn't realize she's nowhere near the top of her game. And that in order for her to compete effectively for a legitimate seven who's willing to go all in and thinks that she's outstanding, she's going to need to be at the top of her game. And so I can just tell you, as a psychotherapist who has dealt with stacks and stacks of women that are dealing with this issue, the story gets told again and again, where they start to date somebody, he seems pretty excited about it, they start to get sexual, and then he starts to fade away pretty quickly, and they're left scratching their head trying to figure out what happened. And what happened was, you know what, the 20 extra pounds just doesn't cut it. And so the guys won't tell you this, but they will talk behind the female's backs, and they will talk to each other, and they are absolutely paying attention to these issues. And as they should, because that 20 pounds mimics pregnancy and essentially is they have a design feature of their psychology, but they're supposed to be turned off by a widening or a reduction of the contours or the contrast between the waistline and the hips.
Mm-hmm. And so for women, the solution is for them to get what they want, which is a long-term pair bond. That's given that they're not extremely open, like novelty seeking. So if they're not, they're kind of average in terms of novelty seeking. They're going to have the most happiness if they do whatever they can do to improve their physique, and that way they can trade fairly with the opposite sex.
Puts you in a much better position to trade. And mm-hmm. so this, you know, this isn't, you know, this sounds, you know, of course, there's going to be, if I've got some feminist listener out there, she could be all appalled. But the truth of the matter is that if we're honest about what's actually happening, and we look through both sides of this telescope, this is what we're going to see. Males are also being examined by females for their physical shape and their condition. It is not as important for males. Remember, males are bringing two factors to the equation. They're bringing money, and they're bringing their bodies. Their bodies are an evidence of their gene quality. As we examine the bodies for beauty, what we call beauty. Beauty is just something that, it's a word we use for an attractive, characteristic of the landscape. We might have a beautiful smell, beautiful sounds, or beautiful sights, even a beautiful touch. So certainly beautiful taste. So it's going to turn out that beauty or attractiveness is just simply an indication that things are good for survival reproduction. And so certainly male beauty is a very big thing in the world of the female mind. And so males can enhance their beauty as well by taking care of themselves in the same type of manner. The and they can improve their standing relative to their competitors. But it's going to turn out that they also need to take care of some other business, and they need to take care of their finances and their achievement displays that they also bring to the table.
And these achievement displays are what? A car, a dwelling, like a house, apartment, condo, what else?
Everything. The most important thing is that you are essentially, what you want to do in actually all of these cases. What you want to be doing is you want your characteristics, to be displayed in quite a good light. It's what I call, you need to be displaying a good rendition of yourself. So you, let's suppose somebody says, well, I don't think cars are that important. So I don't care that I'm driving an old junker that doesn't have, hubcaps on it. So it's like, well, that's fine that you have that opinion, but you are actually out of step with the marketplace. And therefore, you have vastly reduced your market. So what you want to do is you need to understand what is in the minds of the people on the other side of the table in these exchanges. And you need to not get yourself ruled out because you are underperforming in an area where the opposite sex is actually paying attention to. Okay? So that means car, clothes, career, these things, or your house. Or your housing situation. You know, if you're a 23-year-old who's just starting out and you've just got your first job and you're making $23,000 a year and you're in a big city, you're not going to buy a house. You're not going to buy a condo. You're not going to do anything, and nobody would expect you to. But when the female meets you and talks to you, she wants to hear about what you're making of yourself and what your job is and what your plans are for the future. And so you want to be essentially doing a pretty good job of hitting milestones. And if you're not hitting milestones, then you need to expend the energy and the effort and take the risks in order to try to hit them. And so it is not wise to essentially overinvest and try to bluff a female by demonstrating a cue that is outside of what is true about you. So if you make $50,000 a year, you shouldn't be driving a Maserati. Okay, that doesn't make any sense. You shouldn't even be driving a Lexus. That isn't an honest advertisement. You shouldn't be wearing a Rolex watch. So that's not an honest advertisement as to what your achievements are. What you want to do is what I call, you want to grab 80% of your market. So there is going to be 20% of the marketplace that you could have bluffed. If you're a $50,000 a year guy, you could have driven a Maserati and be driving a Rolex, but that's going to mean that the house that you're going to live in is going to be a shack, okay? That you're not going to have much of an apartment because you've got a huge Maserati payment. And effectively, your cues are out of balance with the marketplace, and you are now in trouble because it might work halfway decently for a casual mating strategy where you're trying to bluff females. But in a romantic pair bond situation, females are actually observing how it is that you've evaluated the different cues and your responsibility to display those cues. And how have you distributed your time and energy to try to hit those milestones and those cues in a way that makes sense to her. Okay. And so if she smells a rat that you're actually bluffing and things have been highly distorted, you're going to need a good story. And the truth is that it's so unwise to worry about the fact that, of course, of your market, you could have bluffed and expanded your market on the high end, maybe by a few people, but you will have lost your market on the other end. Let me explain. So let's suppose that females that you would be interested in for a long-term pair bond relationship have a differential sensitivity to the cues, for example, for cars. And it's going to turn out that there's going to be some women that you could get their attention if you're driving a Maserati, even though you can't afford it. But most of the women would be perfectly happy at that socioeconomic status level if you were driving a perfectly clean, nice Camry or Honda Accord. So as a result, they are looking for a guy and would be fine with a guy that's a $50,000 a year earner who should be in a car that looks like an Accord or a Camry. And so or the equivalent. And I'm talking about a $20,000 type of automobile. Now, in that case, you will lose a few because you're not driving the Maserati, so you could have bluffed a few more into the pot. But the truth is you'll lose a few on the other end that as soon as they find out that you blew a bunch of money on Maserati, actually the more responsible, conscientious females that you'd be interested in will be not interested. So as a result, you actually cannot get the entire market on that queue. So the right thing to do is to get most of the market on that queue in such a responsible way that you do not put yourself out of balance with respect to other queues. Okay? So your job is to actually optimize your marketing strategy across multiple queues, and that means essentially trying to get 80% of your market with the queues that you can legitimately get.
Okay, and so we have actually a comment about this. This is a username. So on these forums that I've read, they have a term for the He-Man strategy, and the He-Man, the guy who everyone aspires to be, and his name is Chad. So Chad is this He-Man who's this, you know, alpha male who's like, you know, super ripped and kind of gets casual mating strategy with anybody he really desires. So the user's name is Chad's dad. So Chad's dad wants to know, if you're broadcasting wealth and status through your material possessions, should you be surprised when you attract mates who are most interested in just those things, the money? And how does this affect long-term viability of a relationship or even a person's short-term happiness?
Yeah, well, obviously, if you are able to display these characteristics, if you can afford it, and you are hyper-displaying, then of course it's no surprise that you're going to find females, you're going to attract females who are very interested in getting their hands on that wealth. And so, of course, you have to be thinking about, you know, who is it your market that you're trying to attract. Now, if you are trying to play a casual mating strategy, then you are in however you play it. If you play it with, if you got very fancy looks and a lot of social skill, that's one way to play. Another way to play is to play with by throwing a lot of money around. And essentially, you remember there's two factors inside the female's heads that they're looking at. They're looking at gene quality and they're looking at resources. And so either way, if you can hyper signal with either one of those assets, then you are going to maximize your ability to play casual mating strategy.
However, so those are. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
But the truth is that those are not the same signals. When we hyper signal in those arenas, this is not the same thing as what the female who is looking for a long term pair bond is looking for. So a female in a long-term pair bond isn't just looking for a guy who can throw a lot of money around. In fact, that looks to her like a player who is going to use those assets for short-term mating strategies, and she's not really interested in that. She's actually interested in somebody who looks a lot more responsible, who looks like he's actually hoarding his resources to some reasonable degree so that he can spend them all on one female and her children. Okay? So most pair bond oriented females are not particularly attracted to males who are driving around in red Maseratis or Corvettes with a bunch of gold jewelry hanging from them. So that is why, incidentally, men do not typically do that. Men could easily be displaying a lot more of that kind of bling than they do. Now, when someone is displaying that kind of bling, that is an advertisement that guy is willing to part with assets behind casual mating strategy with the female. But that is also signaling that he is not a pair bond strategy male. And that can be very attractive for some females, as we talked about, because if they get impregnated by such an individual, they pass on that kind of wild, successful He-Man type strategy to their sons. And so therefore it is a genetically viable strategy that some females are genetically inclined to pursue.
Okay. So in terms of improving your attractiveness, I guess, if we have any male listeners, maybe one or two, what they first have to determine is what they want, or is this going to be kind of apparent just based on their own genetics? Whether they want short term or long term, or pair bond.
Yes. In other words, most males know intuitively what it is that they want. They certainly would like to be short term casual matching strategy players if they could. However, they also know the difference between short term casual matching strategy. You know, ideally in the male's head, they would like to play short-term casual mating strategy with females who are 20% more attractive than they are. That would be just grand, okay? Nothing could be better than that. This is a typical fantasy that's rattling around inside of males' heads. But that fantasy doesn't have any basis in reality.
This is where pornography comes from, I'm assuming, right?
Exactly what pornography is. Pornography is selling directly into the male, the ideal male circumstances for reproducing his DNA. In the same way, the absolute corollary of pornography for females is the romance novel. So romance novels sell, close to a billion copies of romance novels sell in the United States every year. And they are read by essentially exclusively by females. And so what these are is they are chick porn, okay? Chick porn is the story of the alpha male prince in the countryside who, there's two women. There's our little heroine who's about an 8 or a 9. You know, she's about an 8.5. And, so she's pretty darn attractive, but there's a bitch in the kingdom that is, you know, one notch more attractive than she is, but she's a bitch. She is bad character. And the prince, who's been deflowering virgins one way or the other all over the countryside, completely legitimately, of course, but he does know the difference between, quote, quality women and non-quality women. But he's a little confused because the bitch has high standing because her dad is a, you know, little kingdom or earl or duke or whatever the hell he is. So she's pretty fancy. And but she's a faithless, you know, kind of slutty, backstabbing bitch that has some superficial social skill that could fool a male that can't see past the great looks. And our prince, of course, can't quite see past this because he's never really, you know, he's not really that deep in women, you know, and not that he's such a man's man and such a, you know, rider of horses and such a swordsman that as a result, he's never really met a really great woman before. But now he meets our heroine, our solid little 8.5. And the adventure of the situation winds up with him, you know, having trials and tribulations and great adventurous stress where he discovers our heroine's great character. Okay. And yet he's so attracted to the slut bitch that he is a dissonance. And then he finds out that the slut bitch is actually a bad actor and he casts her aside, cause he doesn't really care about her that much, particularly now that he's seen her bad character. And what he falls in love, even though he never really thought he could love anybody, miraculously, he loves our heroine, who's an 8.5, with a heart of gold. So this is what I call the myth of inner beauty. So from the female standpoint, she believes that with her great character and her wonderful personality, that she, in fact, deserves the 10. Okay? And so this is chick porn. This is where the chick gets to sleep up into a pair bond situation where the male is not only more attractive than she is, but he's also wealthier than she is. Okay? This is exactly analogous to the male who in pornography meets a hot chick or two or three of them on the street and starts chatting them up. And then the next cut of the film, they're in a foursome with when he's the center of attention, okay, of 3 tens. So this is, you know, didn't even as much as buy him a drink. So i.e. he's given absolutely no resources away, no evidence of any need to signal commitment, and yet the females who are much more attractive than he is are absolutely willing to have sex with him right now. So this is exactly the mirror image. And yet, of course, as a male, I look at this and I say, well, the guy's position is completely reasonable and understandable, and the female's position is disgustingly considered morally above the male's position. Okay. Well, so our culture is that the chick porn is not disgusting. Okay? The male porn is disgusting. And I will argue as an evolutionary psychologist that these two are absolutely equivalent in terms of how it is that they're built.
Well, well said. And I always wonder because for females, there are many techniques that females engage in to make themselves appear more attractive. For example, they can do their hair. They can do the makeup just right. They have all the flashy rocks, basically the jewelry and the earrings, things like that, to attract attention. What can men do that can kind of make them a little bit more fancy besides the displays?
Well, the truth of the matter is, what's pretty cool if you're a female is that you can kind of hide a little bit behind makeup, and makeup can make a difference. And so I would actually caution females about that there are women that can improve dramatically with makeup and are not nearly as attractive with the makeup off as they are with the makeup on, which is a little bit dangerous. Okay, so you can wind up attracting people that when the makeup comes off are not going to be attracted. So that's a little side story we'll get to another day. Now, but both parties, both male and female, would be wise to actually spend some time and energy and some money investing in clothes. It makes sense to have nice clothes. Clothes should be neat. Clothes should fit well. Okay. Clothes should not be old and in any way tattered with old buttons that aren't sharp. Things need to look good. In an interesting situation in this presidential cycle, it turns out, I believe that this is a correct story, but I might be corrected, that I think Donald Trump's suits cost about $20,000. That there's a famous suit maker in New York City, and so Trump and other candidates actually were outclassed in this arena, and some of them scrambled around to try to catch up. So this is extraordinary to realize that the eye can probably pick up the difference between a $5,000 suit and a $20,000 suit, which of course doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter unless you're super wealthy and that you're running for president of the United States. But if you are running to try to get to the magic 10% and you get lucky enough to have a date with a female if you're a 7 and she's an 8, but you feel like she's a 9, and if she might think that you're an 8, so you're sitting on a rare opportunity where the magic 10% could be in play, but there you are, okay? Your teeth are a little yellow and they needed to be bleached, okay? Or they needed to be fixed a little bit. Your complexion is not good because you're eating too much crap, okay? Your hair is not like stylishly or well cut with a reasonable style. You do not have nice clothes. But nice clothes don't have to be expensive. But it takes some energy and some effort to not be boring and out to lunch with that. If you need to get some advice, go to a nice clothing store and get some help from somebody who does this for a living. So you should look good. You should look nice, and you should be willing to invest some time and energy in that process. But for females and males, but particularly females, don't think that this will save you with a waistline that's got 20 pounds too much, because it will not.
Yeah, this reminds me of a time where I just started earning a little bit more money, so I went to the store to get some clothes. Now, this had been the first time that I'd ever gone to get, some stylish clothes and had a bit of money to spend. Of course, I get in the store, I have no idea what I'm supposed to buy. I don't have no idea what looks good on me and what doesn't. So I found a girl who's relatively attractive, and I said, you know what? I'm actually trying to attract girls like you, so could you just, like, let me know what looks good?
Oh, that's a great story. I hope that was there any indication that you might get a date?
Sadly, no. I think I was a little bit too upfront about it, and she got really
nice.
Who would have thought, right? But
thought it was good for trying.
Well, but here's what happened: is she kind of got flustered. She goes, "Oh, okay. Well, we'll let me show you these shirts and this and that." And she kind of started giving me the party line, you know, the generic stuff.
Right.
And I could tell right away that she was just kind of operating on, operating just kind of a standard autopilot. So I said, right. Okay. Find me the gay guy who works here, and let's bring him in.
There you go.
I got good, great clothes good because of that.
There you go. Now, another thing, a final thing that we'll talk about is that remember, this has to do with sort of integrating your whole life. It means that we are not lazy and that we are not taking shortcuts. We all have places in our display, whether it's our appearance, our clothes, our career, our place of residence, our cars. You know, all of these things are components of our displays. And we are never all going to be across the board at the top of our game. That's not going to happen, because life is such that you have to continually be circling around and investing time and energy in any one of these things, and that means that other things wind up in some degree of relative neglect. But the deal is that we need to be honest and clear about the fact that these things are being observed and they are being picked up on by the opposite sex, and we are being vetted, and they are attempting to try to figure out, you know, just what kind of a deal it is with the value proposition that's on the other side. And finally, that when it comes to actually a major component of all this is conversation. And so it's going to turn out that males and females walk through each other's minds. This is completely unlike any other species. Everything else we've talked about, makeup, grooming, hair, clothing, all these kinds of things are actually have analogies in the animal kingdom. They're the equivalent of grooming, territorial display. For example, a guy with a fancy car and clothes and a house is essentially the baboon that has the fanciest little hill that's the hardest one to defend. And so they have direct analogies in the animal kingdom. But there is something for which there is no direct analogy in the animal kingdom, and that is human conversation. So human beings actually talk to each other, and it's estimated that before most children have ever been conceived, the parents of that child have actually probably exchanged a million words. There has been a tremendous amount of conversation. And what they're doing is they're actually walking through each other's minds looking for trouble. They're trying to find the gene quality just as their eyes are looking around the physical being and trying to look for gene quality, and the fingers want to run their fingers along the other person if they're attracted to them, to also look for mutations and look for gene quality. In the same way, the mind, through conversation, wants to walk its way through the mind of the other person and to see where there are problems, see where there are strengths and weaknesses. And it's going to turn out that we need to be ready for that cross-examination. And most of that being ready means that we've done our homework on our life and we've actually done a good job in our life, but maybe we're not that smooth and that good at that process itself. And that's going to take some experience and some failure, just like riding a bicycle. But I had one woman that was actually very attractive, and she got checked up early in life and wound up with two children from two different fathers by the time she was in her early 20s. And not uncommon for a highly attractive woman to wind up in this situation. She was quite bright, but she was also very shy, which is probably why it is that when the more aggressive males came around her, she sort of couldn't say no and hadn't put herself in positions for other options and wound up with two losers in a row. Her two children were marvelous little kids, by the way, because her genes sort of dominated the show. So anyway, fast forward about 10 years. So she responsibly raised these kids on her own and as a paraprofessional, and had just enough money to do a pretty good job, no help from either dad. And then she arrived at a time in her early 30s where it was actually time to start looking for somebody. She felt lonely and had been out of the sexual marketplace for, you know, basically a decade raising her kids. But she was very shy and was intimidated by the process of going on a date, which was extraordinary to me. This woman was easily 90th plus percentile for attractiveness. So it was incredible to me that anybody that good looking and that intelligent was actually very intimidated by this social process. So what we did was as follows. We broke down, this is how you solve all problems. This is what we call how to solve a problem. So we broke down a date at Starbucks into probably no more than an hour. And if we looked at that hour transaction, if we looked at the conversation, that transaction, we'd have to realize that probably we could get the male to do at least 2/3 of the talking. So she wasn't going to have to talk for more than 20 minutes. And a bunch of that 20 minutes, she was going to be asking questions. So we actually came up with the 20 most likely questions that she could ask that made sense. Not very hard to do. And then we realized that the guy would basically just follow suit and turn around and ask her questions that would be the mirror image of the ones that she had asked. That makes sense. And so what we did then was we got ready with answers to the questions that he would ask. And so what we came up with is we came up with short little two minute little answers where she would tell a little story that would answer the question. So we wrote these out, a 2-minute story is about a handwritten one page. So we came up with about 10 of these. So she had something to say. And then we memorized them. And so we simply memorized these little stories so that when they asked, well, where did you go to high school? Oh, well, I went to so-and-so and I had friends there, blah, 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 blah. Okay. And so I did this and I was on the, I don't know, Spanish team, whatever it is. So the point is that she not only had an answer, but she had a little story. Okay. And we, in fact, added a couple self-effacing little jokes in these stories where she wound up with a pie in her face in a couple of these. Now, the reason for this was because by being willing to tell a story about something that happened to you where you were the goofball who wound up on the short end of some stick, this would make her much less intimidating to a male who would otherwise be actually probably intimidated by her looks and worrying about whether he qualifies. And so we talked this through and we experimented with it and we did mock interviews. And within what people don't realize is people actually hate to rehearse in front of anybody. All my clients in 30 years of doing this, they cannot stand rehearsing in front of me. However, one thing that happens is I make them do it anyway. And it turns out that when you rehearse about 6 or 7 or 8 times, you are way better than you were the first time or second time. Everybody's embarrassed that they're just not smooth out the jump because it means that they're not some genetic, brilliant, silver-tongued dog that can, you know, they think that they're showing their incompetence or their weaknesses. But the truth of the matter is they just need some practice. And so it turns out we go over it and over it and over it, and then pretty soon you can do it. So it turns out that what had been a horrible process for her in her life of avoiding dating and actually boxed her into some bad mating choices, in fact, required less than an hour of rehearsals to be ready. Okay. Then we set it up. I told her, always meet them at a place that you already know the place and they may not know the place, and you're extremely comfortable with it. You know what booth you're going to sit in. Go there and sit in that booth a bunch. Bunker yourself in, make it a time of day where it's not nighttime, so there's no other little inferences of anything going on. And we basically peeled away every bit of anxiety that could be in the situation, and she did it. Okay? So, and she was successful at pulling this off. So this is how you solve problems. Big problems, folks, are always just little problems, whether they're financial, whether they're professional, whether they're family problems, whether they're, you know, career, whatever it is. Big problems are little problems. You have to break down the big problems into tiny little steps. And this is how you get to the moon. This is how you build a car. And this is how you build a life. You break things down to their fundamental parts, and you work at those fundamentals until you have enough ability that you can compete effectively.
Success leaves clues, and we can always get to those clues pretty easily.
Wonderful, wonderful. And so what is the corollary for males?
Same thing. I would say that males should pay attention to the fact that one of the things that females complain most about is that males will dominate conversations. So it's very useful for males to also learn how to ask questions and learn how to ask follow-up questions, and also to have self-effacing little stories that they tell, and understand, you know, have something interesting to say. This means that if you don't have anything interesting to say and you feel like you don't know anything about anything, then there's things called books and libraries and learning. And you can get quite knowledgeable about a number of topics, certainly some topics, pretty quickly, and to the point where you can have a reasonable conversation about just about anything. But remember, folks, that the most important thing that the other person wants to get from you is the notion that you are interested in them. And so by actually asking them questions and giving them compliments along the way is going to be the most successful path to getting their attention.
Wonderful. So we did not have time to get to many of the questions that were posted. However, we will be going over them next week. I think we're going to stick with this topic. We've had a pretty good following the last few weeks, and so I think we've hit something here with this topic about love, sex, relationships, and dating. So we will go ahead and end here. Dr. Lyle, do you have any final thoughts?
No, that's good. This is good. And it'll be interesting to see what questions we come up with, because in that way, when one person asks a question, there's probably plenty more that would have asked that question. And so this is a good way for us to get people some ideas that might be useful for them.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.